Right. Let me welcome you to this session. It's Dialogue sponsored. It's the last one before the banquet, and it's called Kindling to Their Fires, Religious Roots of Political Activism. My name is Karen Maloney. I'm the moderator for the panel. I'll make some introductory remarks and then introduce the panelists and turn the time over to them. All right, in December 1987, I traveled to an anti-nuclear demonstration at the Nevada test site with a Hebrew school-educated non-observant Jew and a former member of the Church of Scientology. The three of us began the trip as relative strangers, but 5 hours of jostling together across the desolate Mojave in a closely packed car turned us into confidants. The conversation focused, probably inevitably given our divergent religious backgrounds, on religion, or at least on our divergent religious backgrounds. Wide-eyed to learn that a Mormon had embarked with them willingly on a journey that would culminate in civil disobedience and arrest, both men were even more surprised to learn that my religion had provided me with an incentive to do so. Overcoming his initial shock, however, my Jewish companion proceeded to tell me a story which I would like to repeat here. In 1982, Randy participated in a blockade action which temporarily shut down the Lawrence Livermore Nuclear Weapons Laboratory in California. He describes many of the activists who had gathered for that particular protest as extremely angry and alienated from American society. Still others, fearful of confronting the authorities, were obsessed with affinity group and spokes council meetings. Surprisingly, perhaps, the protest finally got underway. Suddenly, a school bus pulled up, and a group of Christians, mostly young people in their 20s, got off the bus singing and carrying makeshift wooden crosses. Obviously motivated by a deep moral commitment, the Christians continued singing, walked right up to the gate, knelt down in prayer, and waited to be arrested. Unified, disciplined, and at least outwardly better at mastering their fear, they contrasted sharply with the other protesters, whom they had not failed to impress. In Randy's view, political activism for many persons is an ends unto itself and doomed to fail. Conversely, the morally motivated religious activist for whom activism is a means to an end may actually produce results. Not dependent on immediate gratification, the religiously spurred activist is also, in Randy's view, easier to get along with, and someone to whom mainstream America can more readily relate. I don't know that Randy's observations explain the achievements of Chico Mendez, Cesar Chavez, or Nelson Mandela, but one need only look to such examples as Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. to appreciate the powerful role of religious vision in effecting political change. One can also look for such examples closer to home. The five panelists who will address us today are mainstream Americans who feel religiously impelled to change the world, and whose efforts extend conspicuously beyond their homes, local communities, and churches. Dr. King spoke eloquently of an inescapable network of mutuality and decreed that a great individual is a compassionate individual concerned with the least of these, my brethren. Today, five compassionate individuals representing three religious faiths will explore with us their motivation for doing what they do. Larry St. Clair, our first panelist, was born in Roanoke, Virginia. An associate professor of botany at Brigham Young University, he earned an MA in botany from BYU and a PhD in biology from the University of Colorado. Using lichen, he has also worked extensively with the Forest Service doing biological monitoring of air quality in Class 1 wilderness areas in the Intermountain States. A former bishop, Larry is a member of Utah County Clean Air Coalition, working fervently to rid the valley of pollution. Our second panelist, Diana Lee Hershey, is a native of Cedar City. She earned a BA in anthropology from the University of Utah and worked as an executive secretary at the U's College of Law until 1984, when she resigned her position to become a full-time peace worker. This decision later led her to live for a year in a tent at peace camp on the edge of the Nevada test site. Diana is a member of the Salt Lake Monthly Meeting Religious Society of Friends. She is also a member of Utah Peace Test and the Agape Community of Salt Lake, a group she helped to organize to monitor the manufacture and shipment of Trident II missiles. Last winter, in a celebrated trial, Diana was acquitted for trespassing onto property owned by the Hercules Aerospace Division, a manufacturer of Trident II missile parts. This year, she was also awarded the Susie Young Gates Award for dedication to human rights and service to women. Clark Knowlton, our third panelist, was born and raised in Salt Lake City. He graduated from BYU with an MA in sociology and from Vanderbilt University with a PhD. Currently a professor of sociology at the University of Utah, Clark taught previously at Georgia Southern College, New Mexico Highlands University, and Texas Western College. He has won numerous academic and professional honors, participated in multiple professional organizations, including the Central City Community Center, Catholic Community Services, and the Utah Immigration Project, and published enough to fill an impressive 8 pages of his vita. Throughout his career, Clark has actively promoted anti-poverty programs and civil rights for blacks, Chicanos, and Native Americans. Brian Sellers Peterson, our fourth panelist, was raised primarily in Mankato, Minnesota. He earned a BS degree in psychology and education at the University of Minnesota and an MA in theology at Fuller Theological Seminary in Pasadena, California. Brian is an ordained minister of the Episcopal Church and the executive director of the Center for South Africa Ministry, a cooperative ministry of All Saints Parish in Pasadena, the Episcopal Diocese of Los Angeles, and the Presiding Bishop's Fund for World Relief. A committed anti-apartheid and human rights activist, Brian lived in Port Elizabeth, South Africa from 1980 to 84, and now travels to South Africa several times a year. Recently, he was in charge of Bishop Tutu's Southern California itinerary. I'm also proud to note that Brian's grandmother is my mother's oldest sister, which makes Brian my first cousin once removed. Our final panelist, Judy Rasmussen-Dishku, wanted to be here very much today, but her sister passed away this week, and she is now at her funeral in Boston, and she asked me to read her paper. Judy was born in Rexburg, Idaho, and graduated with a BA in political science from BYU. She also earned two master's degrees from Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, where she is a PhD candidate. Judy taught previously at Tufts University and is now an associate professor at Suffolk University in Boston. She is also an avid political activist, with special interests in Central America, Africa, and the Middle East. Her commitment to human rights has led her to organize study trips to Nicaragua, to develop sister city programs in Nicaragua and El Salvador, to participate in such groups as South Africa Defense and Aid and International Defense and Aid for South Africa, and to help to organize a group for battered and sexually abused women. It's my pleasure now to turn the time over to the panelists.
With 6 kids, I think I can project enough to do this without the microphone. Is there any problem in the back? Can you hear all right? Good. The environmental crisis which we are facing today is symptomatic of an ignorant, greedy, lazy, and often evil society. More policies, more rhetoric, more money will not solve the Earth's environmental problems. Only when we stop trying to cure the symptoms of the Earth's environmental sickness will we come to fully understand that the real solutions require changes in our thinking and in our hearts and a significant sacrifice of current lifestyles. The issue is whether we will make the changes because of wisdom or be compelled to change because of environmental catastrophe. Our reluctance to seriously address environmental issues is based on at least 5 fundamental misunderstandings of Scripture. These misunderstandings are not merely academic or doctrinal, but central to the perpetuation of life on earth and the spiritual and temporal edification of all of God's creatures. First, we have misunderstood the commandment to have dominion over the earth and subdue it. Too often we have interpreted this to mean that we own the earth and thus have an unlimited right to plunder it and devour its resources for our own pleasure. This misinterpretation is manifested in greed, self-justification, and rapaciousness. But its weakness is revealed in environmental pollution and resource depletion so dramatic as to jeopardize the very lives of future generations. In contrast, the Lord intended the earth to be a revolving stewardship, to be passed from generation to generation, with each generation using the earth's resources to meet real temporal needs and justifiable wants, while consistently conserving and protecting the earth so that it might be maintained as a healthy, vibrant home for generations yet to come. The second misunderstanding stems from a misinterpretation of Doctrine and Covenants, section 104, verse 17, which says, in part, "For the earth is full, and there is enough and to spare. careful reading of the context of verse 17 reveals that this passage was never intended to justify wanton consumption of earth resources. It reads as follows, "For it is expedient that I, the Lord, should make every man accountable as a steward over earthly blessings, which I have made and prepared for my creatures. I, the Lord, stretched out the heavens and built the earth, my very handiwork, and all things therein are mine. And it is my purpose to provide for my saints, for all things are mine. But it must needs be done in mine own way. And behold, this is the way that I, the Lord, have decreed to provide for my saints, that the poor be exalted and that the rich are made low. For the earth is full and there is enough and to spare. Yea, I prepared all things and have given unto the children of men to be agents unto themselves. Therefore, if any man shall take of the abundance which I have made, and impart not his portion according to the law of my gospel unto the poor and the needy, he shall with the wicked lift up his eyes in hell, being in torment." Five times in this passage, the Lord asserts his title to the earth, not ours, and specifies that his earthly resources are for the use of the saints and the poor, not to be squandered on the lusts of the rich and powerful. The saints as stewards over the earth's abundance will prosper from generation to generation only if they take what they need and consecrate the rest for the poor, and are careful not to neglect or abuse all the other creatures who share the earth with them. This is the law of consecration upon which our presence on the earth and use of its resources are predicated. Consecration in no way justifies today's levels of consumption, production, profit, riches, and accumulation. Far too many of us are forfeiting our inheritance in the kingdom through self-centered exploitation of air, water, minerals, animals, plants, and especially other people, and in some cases, entire communities. Our voracious consumption of earthly resources is a usurpation for which we will be tormented hereafter. As blessings are predicated upon obedience to eternal law, and promises are suspended for disobedience, we uphold the rich and their political allies at the peril of our own temporal survival and spiritual salvation. The third misunderstanding relates to our place in the natural world. We tend to see ourselves as a special creation with ultimate biological control, uniquely independent of and even transcendent over natural systems. If difficulties arise because of our use or misuse of the earth, we believe that human technology will solve the problem. In reality, natural laws are inescapable and govern all life on earth, including human life. For example, one such law is that life needs air. If we pollute the air, all life forms will suffer poor health and higher mortality. Simply stated, noxious fumes are not good for living things, whether tobacco smoke, automobile exhaust, or industrial discharge. It is the law. On a more global level, the atmosphere is physically and chemically set to sustain life within a narrow range of temperature, precipitation, and sunlight. We will not have temperate climate with rain in season if we choose to destabilize the atmosphere with chemicals deleterious to life and to the system God has set up. It is the law. The Earth's resilience and capacity to absorb our environmental irresponsibility is limited. The earth will not, however, deal out its own abuse in response to our repeated violation of its laws. It is too similar to its maker to act so revengefully. Rather, like a beast of burden, overworked and abused, it will grow weaker and sicker, and finally, stripped of its vitality and resilience, it will simply lie down and die. Consider the prophesied catastrophes of a darkened sun and a bloodied moon, vapors of smoke, great pollutions, waves of the sea heaving themselves beyond their bounds, famines, thunder, fierce and vivid lightning, tempests, earthquakes, and hailstorms in the last days. These universal perturbations are symptoms of deep infection by violent, abusive misstewardship and evil, more than simply divine punishment among the wicked. For if, as Enoch observed, the earth itself suffers and cries out in pain over the evil inflicted upon it, can we expect that its life-sustaining system should continue unimpacted? Woe, woe is me, the mother of men. I am pained, I am weary, because of the wickedness of my children. Technology has beguiled us with the notion that we can save ourselves from the results of our own environmental abuse by manipulating the natural laws which govern the earth. Most technological advances are driven by profit and have been the cause of, not the solution to, environmental deterioration. In Satan's world, funding for profitable technology, however dirty and destructive, will always outpace funding for research into technological solutions. The fourth misunderstanding is that the Lord will solve all our problems, environmental and otherwise. In reality, the Lord has made it clear that we are personally accountable for what we know and what we do with our knowledge. Consequences of poor management, greed, irresponsibility, and apathy will be visited upon us. The Lord has said, "Whosoever perisheth unto himself, and whosoever doeth iniquity, doeth it unto himself. For behold, ye are free, ye are permitted to act for yourselves. For behold, God hath given unto you a knowledge, and he hath made you free. He hath given unto you that you might know good from evil, and he hath given unto you that you might choose life or death. Thus, if we choose to defile the earth, then we must live with the stench, sickness, death, and ugliness of a ravaged environment, and will answer to the Creator for desecrating his property." The Lord does not interrupt free agency, and he suspends the consequences of poor exercise of agency only for the repentant. Again, our options are desecration or consecration. If we choose consecration, the fullness of a renewed paradisical earth will be ours, and we will inherit all the Father has. If we choose desecration, we will remain under degraded conditions, and the Lord himself will weep over our loss. The fifth misunderstanding of Scripture, responsible for environmental degradation, and possibly most pernicious and most perverted of all, is that worldly riches, power, and influence are the rewards of faithfulness. Some invoke preexistent faithfulness to explain their extensive temporal holdings and other worldly favor. Many consider TVs, VCRs, RVs, telephone answering machines, luxury cars, and boats to indicate special divine favor. None of this, however, has any basis in revealed theology. The Lord deplores not only financial and social disparity, but the pursuit of riches itself is altogether abominable to him. The Lord has said, "Seek not for riches, but for wisdom. And behold, the mysteries of God shall be unfolded unto you. And then shall you be made rich. Behold, he that hath eternal life is rich." Political and economic powers, false social systems, ignorance, apathy, insensitivity, greed, and other evils cause human misery, social disparity, and environmental havoc. God is not responsible for these collective and individual failings. He commands us to be healed of all such social ills through the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, his Son. Nevertheless, he has forever renounced the use of force to correct human defects and waits for us to come to sanity, either motivated by wisdom or compelled by human-induced catastrophe. The implications of biologic catastrophe or of a planet in peril are all around us. Scientists are monitoring the disappearance of frogs, birds, predatory animals, lichens, forests, and other species one by one. The environment is unraveling before our very eyes. The question before us is, will catastrophe force us at an enormous cost in human and biologic life to make changes at some future time, or will we ourselves take political and individual action now? We must cultivate a sensitivity for the infinite and eternal beauty of the earth, deepen our reverence for God in his capacity as a creator, and follow his admonition in section 88 of the Doctrine and Covenants. "Teach ye diligently, and my grace shall attend you, that you may be instructed more perfectly in theory, in principle, in doctrine, in the law of the gospel, in all things that pertain unto the kingdom of God, that are expedient for you to understand, of things both in heaven and in the earth and under the earth, things which have been, things which are, things which must shortly come to pass, that ye may be prepared in all things when I shall send you again to magnify the calling whereunto I have called you, and the mission with which I have commissioned you." We must henceforth cease to regard the earth as a commodity belonging to us. It is a community of living things, including ourselves. As we begin to comprehend this, we will have a genuine desire to love, respect, and protect the earth. We must reevaluate and bring our personal values into harmony with eternal principles. We must acknowledge that free agency has temporal and spiritual consequences. It places upon each of us a responsibility which we cannot evade. We must recognize that those with the greatest resources have the greatest responsibility to use them to care for the earth and all inhabitants. We must carefully consider and act on our personal responsibility to protect and sustain the earth for future generations by changing patterns in our own lives which diminish the life-sustaining capacities of the earth. We must never allow ourselves to become casual in our use of earth resources. Every gift from the earth should be received with deep feelings of reverence and gratitude. We must consume less, pollute less, discard less, conserve more, recycle more, and share more. We must remember that our relationship with one another and the earth must always be based on personal integrity. We must do what is right always and not just when it is economically feasible or personally profitable. Anything less is irresponsible and exploitative. We must cleanse our hearts of the influences of a world corrupted by greed, hate, evil, and selfishness. We must seek to find greater joy and happiness in virtue, truth, charity, kindness, simplicity, sacrifice, and gentleness. Finally, because political and financial conspiracies will frustrate our most exhaustive collective efforts, we must pray for the safety of our earth home relative to issues both global and local. And when Enoch heard the earth mourn, he wept and cried unto the Lord, saying, O Lord, wilt thou not have compassion upon the earth? After many years of plunder and abuse, we now find ourselves at a crossroads of understanding, at which we may choose between despolation and nurturance or between desecration and consecration. Global catastrophe is probably imminent. Only in consecrated Zion will there be safety. But Zion will not, cannot be established with our present lifestyles of consumption, opulence, and pleasure. The luxury cars, the big boats, the ATCs of the young, the RVs of the retired, and all such things must be sacrificed if we are to shoulder personal and collective responsibility for establishing Zion. If we fail to do so, we shall face the climatologic and biologic storms of a ravaged and dying planet alone. On the other hand, Zion will not be moved and will be a place of spiritual and temporal splendor in perpetuity. It will be a place such as was described by Hugh Iltis with this gentle recommendation. If we love our children, we must love the earth with tender care and pass it on, diverse and beautiful, so that on a warm spring day 10,000 years hence, they can feel peace in a sea of grass, can watch a bee visit a flower, and can hear a sandpiper call in the sky, and can find joy in being alive.
Can you hear me okay? Yes? No. Now can you hear me okay? Okay. I'm going to begin with some words from Starhawk in her recent book, Truth or Dare. And she says, we can become agents of the earth's soul, raging, passionate, and fearless in our labor, bringing to birth what perhaps has never been, a world in which no one is ruled or ruler, where we tend together the earth's living, fruitful flesh to grant each other the long life, abundant and peaceful, shared as equals, and lived in freedom. And now my story. I stood at the Shrine of the Shadow Children across the highway from the Nevada test site where the United States tests nuclear weapons. I stood with a young man from Kazakhstan, where the Soviet Union tests nuclear weapons. As we embraced, I felt we represented the dissolution of hatred between the two nations. Khairat Umarov said to me, "We want to stop." I replied, "So do we." I knew then that the unity of ordinary people in their desire for peace would end nuclear weapons testing. The Shadow Children are two plaster of Paris statues, one black, the other white, weathering in the Nevada desert. They symbolize the children of the world charred and vaporized by radiation. And there in a circle of white rocks is a simple memorial. Underneath the rocks, people have left photographs of friends and relatives who lived downwind and died from radiation. And we have, in our idolatry, sacrificed these people to the gods of power, greed, and domination. For over 300 years, Quakers have witnessed against war and the preparation for war, have looked for that of God in everyone, and have spoken truth to power with love. In some ways, Quakers are like Mormons. We practice an experiential religion. The truth comes to us through our relationship with God and not through an ordained ministry. Each person has the free agency to determine how to practice his or her religion. We believe in a continuing prophetic witness that sometimes calls individuals to radical action. And both Mormons and Quakers are called upon to make their faith visible through works. The journey that has brought me here today began early in the last decade when my husband, Rand, showed me some suggestions to prevent nuclear war, published in the 1981 edition of Coevolution magazine. Two of the suggestions, which were made by Aaliyah Johnson, the author, were that we each get to know the bomb in our own hearts, and that we get to know the bomb in our backyard. I grew up downwind in southern Utah. In 1975, my father died at the age of 59 as the result, I now believe, of fallout from the 1950s open-air testing at the Nevada test site. I didn't want to think about nuclear weapons, but that ominous cloud was always there. And when I read those suggestions, something snapped. In 1945, when I was 3 years old, the United States dropped a 12-kiloton nuclear bomb on the Japanese city of Hiroshima. People's faces melted. Their clothes were grafted onto their skin. Over 100,000 died. Since then, over 1,700 nuclear weapons have been tested worldwide, more than 700 of them by the United States. So far in 1990 alone, we have had 4 reported nuclear weapons tests, each one with the explosive power of 20 kilotons. That's 7 times the power of Hiroshima. 45 years after that tragedy, the devastation of Hiroshima, this country is today constructing the Trident submarine-launched missile system at an estimated cost of $135 billion. Trident has first-strike capability, and when all 20 submarines have been launched, and we have 9 in the water right now, plans for 20, we will have in that fleet the explosive power of 7,000 Hiroshimas. The Hercules plant in West Valley City, in our backyard, manufactures the motors for the Trident missile. I found out about the Trax campaign, a grassroots movement made up of people monitoring the shipment by rail of Trident missile components across the United States. These people are committed to nonviolent direct action grounded in faith and love. The local group, the Agape Community of Salt Lake, has been monitoring missile motor shipments and vigiling every month at Hercules for almost 7 years. As I learned about the bomb in our backyard, I had to face the bomb in my heart, the bomb of self-righteous judgment, criticism, anger, and dishonesty. That hasn't been particularly pleasant. And though I don't understand it completely, I believe that that bomb in my heart is directly related to that bomb in our backyard. And I've had to examine the one in my heart and become willing to change, to give up blaming, to pursue sanity and compassion, and to make nonviolence a part of my daily life. And it isn't easy. One day, my friend Barbara McFarland told me that to save the planet, we all had to devote 10% of our time to peacemaking. My 10% grew until I was overwhelmed with my job, my family, and the TRACS campaign. That summer, in July of 1985, two women from Greenham Common, a peace camp outside the United States Cruise Missile Base in England, visited Salt Lake. They had left their regular jobs to work for nuclear disarmament. Their vision so inspired me that I went right home and told my husband I decided to quit my job and work for nuclear disarmament, and he was not amused, nor was he immediately supportive. A year of soul-searching followed that declaration. I counseled with family and friends. I went through a clearness process with members of my Quaker meeting. Gathering with me in a spirit of prayerful seeking, these friends helped me with my decision. Now, Quaker women have traditionally traveled alone to distant places to bear witness. I had no idea then that I would join them, that I would end up in a tent in the middle of the harsh Nevada desert, living for weeks at a time, getting up at 5 a.m. to vigil at the gates of hell, or that I would go on trial in a circuit court in West Valley City, Utah, charged with criminal trespass. I left my secretarial job at the University of Utah on September 1st, 1986. I had been active in the TRACS campaign for a while when my daughter, Heather, suggested joining the Utahns involved in nonviolent direct action at the Nevada test site. I said, no, I can't do that. It's too hard. It's too scary. And besides that, I'm busy vigiling at Hercules. However, she talked me into going to a rally at the federal building in Salt Lake protesting a nuclear weapons test. And the love and the strength I felt at that rally convinced me to go. And what a peace test that was. My daughter and I traveled to and braved not only the desert, but the glitter of downtown Las Vegas. And we survived. Just barely. And I returned to the desert again and again. For the better part of a year, I lived at the peace camp across the highway from the test site. Being constantly aware of nuclear weapons was depressing. People who were not there with me but knew of my witness there also had to be constantly aware of nuclear weapons. Coping with the daily hassles of living with other peace campers took energy and dedication. We were forced to be creative in solving our problems nonviolently. Sometimes, just looking across the highway at the madness there brought things into perspective. It made us acutely aware of the responsibility we had to each other to make peace camp work, the same responsibility we all have to make our lives on this planet work. Last October, a campaign of nonviolent direct action by the Agape Community and Utah Peace Test culminated in the first civil resistance action at a nuclear facility in Utah. About 25 of us gathered at the railroad tracks where the Trident missile motors are shipped from Hercules to the submarine base in Kings Bay, Georgia. Matthew Hahn, Marvin Hamilton, and I carried a Stop Trident banner across the line, making a symbolic statement that we would no longer, by our silence, give consent to what we believe are the immoral and illegal acts of our government. We were arrested and charged with criminal trespass, a charge which carries a possible 3-month jail sentence. It was an extraordinary trial. Judge William Thorne allowed expert testimony about nuclear weapons and instructed the defenses based on international law and First Amendment rights of freedom of speech and religion. Few times have nuclear resistors been allowed jury trials, and we know of no other case in which they've been allowed international law and First Amendment defenses. And finally, a courageous jury found us not guilty. The room erupted. Some cried. The defendants hugged each other and their supporters. We were stunned and overcome with joy. These days, I'm in Salt Lake Moor with my family, Rand, Heather, and my son Lincoln. The daily presence that Utah Peace Test and others maintained for 3 years at the Nevada Test Site has been laid down. Still, people make pilgrimages there. The vigils continue at Hercules. The Soviets have not tested any nuclear weapons since October 1989. The Berlin Wall has crumbled. The Cold War is over. In contrast, Hercules continues to ship Trident missile motors to Kings Bay. Nuclear weapons testing continues at the Nevada test site. And the United States is now sending troops and arms to the Middle East, and a local congressional candidate has suggested using nuclear weapons there. Trident, nuclear weapons testing, and our preparation for war in the Middle East are all part of the same dangerous militaristic system, and we all live downwind. Thank you.
I wasn't quite sure how to deal with this subject, whether to present a philosophical analysis of my own beliefs, or whether to discuss the process by which an Orthodox Mormon sociologist became a radical activist. This process did not begin with any vision or from a perusal of left-wing literature. Began as a result of personal experiences, some of which I would like to relate to you. Began in the Depression of the 1930s, and then it reached full flowering in the civil rights movements among the Mexican Americans, the Native Americans in the Southwest in the 1960s and early 1970s. I was born into what could be called an upper middle class, very Orthodox Mormon family. One generation on my mother's side, and only two generations on my father's side, removed from the frontier. The community in which I was born was 99% Mormon. I never had a non-Mormon friend until I went on a mission. I never had a close one until I was in the Army. This community was composed of small farmers, for the most part. It was a equalitarian community. Very few were rich. And there were very few that were poor. Rather, a communitarian community in which everyone seemed to care for everyone else. If a farmer broke his leg on a tractor, everybody else came out to get his harvest in. If a house burnt down, it was rebuilt. There were people there who had experienced almost the full process of Mormon history as had my own ancestors. From the experience in Missouri, Illinois, the crossing the plains, these pioneer period in Utah and Arizona, the federal harassment of the Mormons. In fact, one of my great-grandfathers was a Mormon militiaman who rode through the federal troops in 1851 trying to stampede their horses and mules as the troops were approaching Utah. Now, when I taught in the South, this was very useful to me because one of the first questions I was asked by my students and fellow colleagues from the South, are you a damn Yankee? And I said, no, I'm a rebel. What do you mean you're a rebel? You weren't born in the South. I said, well, my own people fought their own war against the federal government, and they lost too. So I come from rebel stock. And they accepted that, and they accepted me fully, which they didn't always do with those who came from New York or from Boston or Massachusetts. When the Depression came, I was just approaching the age of 11, 12. Our community was deeply hit by that and the drought. We didn't starve, but there was a general retrenchment, a general feeling of malaise. I noted that the ward of which I was a member sponsored several New Deal projects, WPA projects in terms of some irrigation ditches, improving the water supply, and so on. At a time when President Grant was attacking the New Deal, these wards were applying for New Deal projects. I was very much interested as I moved into adolescence why the Depression came, who is responsible, why the suffering. I remember machine guns on Utah State Capitol grounds as miners were rioting and demanding jobs and food. So I began to ask some of the fundamental questions, and my father was willing to discuss them with me. At that time, I virtually lost my faith in the free enterprise system as I saw it operating during the Depression. I went, when I was 14, 15, 16, I went to every political rally that I could drag my father into taking me. By the time I was 16, I attended communist meetings in Salt Lake City. I attended socialist meetings, got turned off by the communists or the cell on the University of Utah campus at the time. Very interesting to do a study of the communist movement in Utah, as well as the socialist movement. I came in contact with elderly Mormons who had been very active in the Socialist Party in the 1900s in Utah. And they pointed out to me that there were Mormon stake presidents who were running for positions on the socialist ticket with the encouragement of certain general authorities. So that there was a radical tradition within Mormonism, although it's only flickering now. But at that time, it had far more vigor than it does now. When I was 18 or 19, might say this too. By the time I was 16, I was working away from home at any kind of a job that my father could get me or I could get me. I worked in construction. I dug ditches. I helped to clean city streets. I tied steel on construction jobs. I worked in a survey crew for the U.S. Bureau of Public Road. And among the fellow workers, I met people of all kinds. Oftentimes, I was the youngest person on the job, and I was the only Mormon on the job. And I worked in Wyoming, Idaho, and Utah in various sites. It would have been very easy for these workers to have corrupted me, but indeed they sort of fathered me and kept me safe from some of their own activities that they engaged in during the weekend. They just simply would not let me go with them. But I did come in contact with the remnants, the old wobbly tradition, the workers of the world unite, and with the Western Federation of Miners. I worked with some people, old men, and I remember still the fragments of a wobbly song. I don't know why I remembered, but it goes that the long-haired preachers come out tonight, long-haired preachers come out tonight, long-haired preachers come out tonight to dance by the light of the moon. What that means, I don't know. That's the only verse. That's the only thing I remember of the wobblies I worked with. But nonetheless, it deeply influenced me to hear those old men talk about the repression they went through, about the jail terms they served in the 1890s, 1900s, and 1910s. I'm not sure my father realized what this did to me, sending me out to work almost every summer from the time I was literally 15 on up until I was 18. Although I grew up in a middle-class home, the values I had acquired were those of the working class, and I defined myself as a member of the working class and not a member of the middle class, and even today I still have some of that orientation. Remember, when I was 16, I was a card-carrying member of the physical labor union, and I value that very highly. I was 19, I was called on a mission to Argentina. And when I went down there, as though I really come home in some ways, I learned Spanish in less than 2 months. And we only got $30 a month to support us during the war. So sometimes the money didn't arrive, and we were virtually forced to live with the people. At that time, we did our missionary work primarily among the low-income Argentine families. And I learned to love them. I studied Argentine history, Argentine culture, Argentine literature, and develop a deeper appreciation for the tango. I'm not sure that my mission president approved of all those activities, but nonetheless, I felt it might make me a better missionary. And I remembered Brigham Young's advice when he sent some of his own sons out on a mission, learn all about the country in which you are serving that you can. So I followed his advice. But in Argentina, I came in contact with refugees from every part of the world, from the Spanish Civil War, from Nazism in Germany, from fascism in Italy. I came in contact with anarchists who had fought in the ranks of the Spanish Republican Army. And very often, I'd discuss Mormonism with them in the morning, and then they would preach anarchism, socialism, everything else to me in the afternoon. I mean, my mission in many ways was, for me, my orientation and introduction to the cold, harsh reality of the real world. I'd never heard these doctrines before, except vaguely mentioned in labor camp. I gather one of the most important skills I acquired in these labor camps was playing a poker. It came in very handy in the Army. It helped me to pass many hours and earn a little money besides my military pay. But at least I did become familiar with all the doctrine. I heard the stories of torture, the stories of persecution. And it turned me very much inoculated against all totalitarian doctrines. When I turned my mission, I was drafted in the army immediately, went up in the infantry, and went overseas into combat in France. But I remember very vividly in the course of our basic training, we were told we were the best fed, best trained, best equipped, best armed soldiers in the world. The first time that my unit was ever involved in a firefight with the Germans, I knew someone had lied to us terribly. Our tanks ran from the German tanks. They had better machine guns than we did. They had smokeless powder. We had smoke powder. They had better winter clothes. They had better almost of everything except a rifle and a 50 caliber machine gun. I was slightly wounded in action. I wound up in a hospital in England, spent a year in England finishing out the war there. But again, I was deeply curious about England. I hitchhiked all over the country. To the best of my abilities, I was in limited service. Anytime I didn't want to work, I simply reported myself into the medics that my wounds were itching, and they would promptly give me a week or two off to recover. And I needed to recover all the time I was in England. And so I attended classes at Cambridge University. I got involved in Labor Party activities, which no American soldier should do. But I attended all political meetings I could in England.
Central America has pushed me further and further in my commitment to Jesus Christ for peace and justice in this world. The murder of the Jesuit priest in El Salvador late last year moved a large group of people from across the religious, racial, and economic spectrum of Southern California to protest the U.S. involvement in El Salvador. Through the encouragement of the Reverend Jim Lawson, a board member of mine, who served Dr. Martin Luther King in the 1950s and 60s as King's teacher and mentor in the use of nonviolent direct action, I was led into what is called the Wednesday Morning Coalition for a march to the nearby federal building for prayer, hymn singing, protest, and arrest. Arrest for barricading the doors, which effectively closes the building until we are removed by federal marshals. Sometimes it is late in the afternoon before we are released. During the period of protest, arrest, processing, and the long wait in the holding cells before release, many close friendships are formed. Once we are all together in the holding cell, we form a circle and share our reasons for being there and our common faith. Usually it is a religious conviction, combined especially in the case of Jesuit priests from throughout Southern California, it is because of their murdered brothers in Salvador. For a sizable group, many there for the first time, full of apprehension and sometimes fear, not so much for being in jail, but where it might lead in terms of their relationships with family and friends. Others still come for political reasons alone, as was the case of two atheist ACT UP members. ACT UP is a radical AIDS coalition. They were there to express solidarity, but they brought with them hope as well. One of the regulars is a man named Ramon. He's a highly unlikely candidate for civil disobedience and the deprivation of any kind of comfort. He is a very wealthy movie star. He is there week in and week out. We see Ramon as a genuine leader, a mantle he steadfastly refuses. He always defers to the ministers in our midst and to other people with who cannot hold a candle to him in terms of his wisdom. He is an active recruiter and proselytizer, always bringing friends to be busted. He once brought Jackson Brown and Chris Christopherson with him, and they gave us a free concert in the holding cell. Whenever his name is called out for release, we all chuckle, since we know him by his stage name, Martin Sheen, not his given name, Ramon Estevez. Why does Ramon come week in and week out? The answer I hear from him over and over again, he comes because of his life in Christ. The religious fervor and oft-times fury of people like Jim Lawson and Martin Sheen and countless others reminds me that I am not alone. I am not a crazy loner. I am not a member of a fringe minority. It has also challenged me to consider other acts of civil disobedience. Some I have acted on, others not. Even with time constraints, family responsibilities, and work, I have concluded I must be with my padres, my madres, my friends, my colleagues, my enemies, all the same, in prayer, always in prayer. So when a bus leaves for the Nevada test site without me, I go too, in prayer. When a child goes to jail in South Africa because they protest peacefully, I go too, in prayer. When I am too busy to make it to the federal building to say no to U.S. intervention in Central America, I go with my friends too, in prayer. It is hard to find concrete results for my activism. It's one of the greatest frustrations I feel. It is hard to know if the letters that I write to the state president of South Africa are ever received. It is hard to know if that specific letter fell on his ears that helped Charles Bester out of prison just last week. I will never know. I find it difficult to know if my boycott of Shell products has moved Shell to consider leaving South Africa, to further isolating that country to leverage genuine political change. I don't know. I don't know if my hours in prison on behalf of murdered Jesuits in El Salvador has encouraged our government to change its foreign policy with El Salvador. But knowing that I am bound and knit together with Christians around the country who pray, who lobby the government, who risk arrest, who are estranged from their families for their involvement, gives me hope that change is inevitable and it is in fact a matter of time until justice rolls down. People in the South African Diplomatic Corps have told me and others that our efforts have made a difference. They say Mandela would not be free. De Klerk would not be so bold in striving for change if we had not treated South Africa in a business-as-usual manner, if we had not worked so hard to isolate that government. I know that if I am patient, I know that if I stop and enjoy small successes, I know that if I encourage just one person to live their faith in such a way that they will, in fact, make a difference, I know the cause of Christ will be forwarded and that peace will, in fact, break out. If not for a whole country, if not for a whole city, if not for a whole family, maybe for just one person, maybe for me.
If you came in late, I'm not Judy Dishku, but I'm Karen Maloney, and I'm reading Judy's paper, which is entitled Mormonism as a Revolutionary Religion. For reasons not altogether clear to me, I struggle in church describing who I am and what I do with my life. I presume I will not be understood. To myself, I say that I am a human rights activist. I'm involved in an international struggle for human dignity and equality. I believe in a radical redistribution of wealth and power that will benefit the majority of human beings and empower them to create their own destinies. I see that while I fight on many fronts, I'm basically a soldier in the International Liberation Army. For years, I excused my clumsiness with explaining myself to Mormons by saying simply that it was more correct to separate one's politics from one's religious life. I said that religion was too sacred to mix it with something so worldly as political activity. While this never seemed quite true, I had the notion that my politics would remain separate from my church. However, 3 years ago I spoke at the Sunstone Symposium. It required me to search into the deepest part of my soul for the real pillars of my faith. There I had to recognize the silliness in keeping these worlds apart. I discovered that wanting to rid the world of all oppression and abuse of power, wanting to free people to be all that they can be, and wanting to rid the world of evil hierarchies are the passionate principles that guide my life, and they came directly from my growing up years as a young Mormon girl. These principles were taught to me as Mormonism, as the pillars of my faith. I am driven in my political activities by Mormonism as it was taught to me. Any division between my religious beliefs and serious political activism seems unnatural, and I want the barriers torn down. I want to be my full LDS self with LDS people. For the first 17 years of my life, I was taught the gospel primarily and nearly exclusively by my own father and mother, and since they were from Idaho, in the heart of the Mormon Zion, I had no reason to doubt that they were anything other than the most authentic and typical representatives of God's Latter-day Kingdom. And so the gospel, as I learned it from them, I assumed to be the same gospel that Mormons everywhere embraced. Just what was this Mormon gospel I was taught by my parents? First of all, it was revolutionary. It required positive changes in people's attitudes and behaviors. It was a gospel that required people to be dissatisfied with things as they were, if they were hurtful or stood in the way of joy and goodness. It was a gospel that challenged the status quo and required people to work together for the creation of a better community and better individual lives within it. At core was and is the belief that the gospel of Jesus Christ is the most effective force in all the world for positive change in individuals' lives and the life of communities and groups. It is so powerfully effective because what this gospel says to people is that each of them is part of the family of Jesus and is therefore very important. This fact of human importance has nothing to do with existing economic class rank, which may elevate or oppress the status of people in this worldly community. In fact, where such class divisions exist, or where discrimination or oppression exists, they are barriers to people really understanding and acclaiming their equality and wholeness in the human family. At best, these barriers should be removed. But if they cannot be entirely removed, then at the very least, people from all places in society deserve the opportunity to join a community of saints who meticulously ignore or denounce all rankings of people and all systems of discrimination and prejudice, and who understand this gospel of dignity and equality. It was my clear understanding, taught to me by my parents, that in this community of saints there is no better way for human beings to fully appreciate each other's equal value, beauty, and worth than by both serving and leading one another. It was ineffective if anyone or any group perpetually led or perpetually served. Thus, this gospel had a good deal to do with acknowledging power in all people, but nothing to do with granting anyone entitlement to continuous power, especially over others. Hymn singing was a big part of my religious life as a young girl, as it is now, and the hymns we sang accompanied all the spiritual drama that unfolded in our lives. Not oddly, many of my mother's favorite hymns became mine too. A cursory content analysis of them quickly reveals that they are enthusiastically millennialist. They speak to the imminent second coming of the Savior, and they speak directly to the need for us all to transform the earth in preparation for that event. They are stirring songs that speak in very revolutionary terms of the morning breaks, the shadows flee, lo, Zion's standard is unfurled, the dawning of a brighter day, majestic, rises o'er the world. Lo, Israel, filled with joy, shall now be gathered home, their wealth and means employ to build Jerusalem. while Zion shall arise and shine and fill the earth with truth divine. Or another, though outward ills await us here, the time at longest is not long, ere Jesus Christ will reappear surrounded by a glorious throng. There are numerous others, each describing what for me was the scene before me as a kid in a small branch in Kirkland, Washington. I remember the principles of the Gospels I learned in that tiny branch. They were these principles of human transformation. When people saw their worth and decided, perhaps for the first time on earth, to move forward and seize their own power to be what they could be. They are the same principles taught elsewhere in revolutionary settings where other people, who remind me of the Mormons of my youth, experience that same kind of personal transformation. When I see it now, wherever I am, Matagalpa, Nicaragua, or Ilasabugu, Mali, in West Africa, these hymns seem like the appropriate accompaniment for what feels to me still like the most important work of the Lord being fulfilled. My memories of what went on in that little branch in Washington may not resemble the larger reality that people who were adults there when I was a child might recall. What I remember are people who were struggling with economic hardship in their daily lives and beaten down with feeling outside of the comfortable mainstream of society. I seem to remember faces of parents of what we would call today special needs children giving their all for those kids. I remember people without rides to church and without other common conveniences. I remember people who apologized for themselves and were self-conscious about their teeth and their clothes. We met for a while in a rented room, and that was initially embarrassing since it was by no means a real church. There was at first a collective shame about being there. Sometimes we did not get sacrament cups, and we shared a common glass that we wiped off after we sipped our sip of water. But of course, we shared this gospel of power and light. And together we supported each other, and people who one year seemed faint-hearted and self-effacing became well-spoken, even outspoken, and went from being humble learners to teachers and preachers of the word. They stopped apologizing for themselves and lost their self-consciousness. It felt fabulous to be part of this. My parents loved it, and I did too. As soon as we would drop off our last rider after Sunday school, my parents would begin to exclaim over the tremendous growth that some fellow saint had made. There were always, "Remember when dear sister so-and-so was so afraid to sing, and just look at her now." Somehow, even economic difficulties would diminish, and people would look different over time, as well as act different. Naturally, I associated this with the revolutionary power of the gospel. It created change. It made people's worlds different and much better. It made the poor become richer and the powerless become powerful. I loved it. I associated it with Mormonism, my revolutionary religion. When I first went to Nicaragua, I remember visiting a small room with some young women who were part of an organization called AMLAE. It is the Women's Auxiliary Organization to the Revolutionary Sandinista Party. Besides actual combat revolutionary activity, AMLAE has had at its goal the transforming of women's lives and giving women in Nicaragua a sense of being strong, powerful, free, and capable of leadership. The women we met told us about how their AMLAE work had helped them feel less economically bound to poverty and hopelessness. There was a touching story about finding a young, hungry widow with several children isolated in the mountains, unaware of the triumph of the revolution. AMLAE women went and nursed all to health, then taught the widow nursing. Now she is an able administrator of a children's health center. As I sat through this meeting with the Nicaraguan women, I felt absolutely at home and as though I were in the church of my youth. I know, and if I forget, my dear friends who are not Mormon remind me, there is a contradiction between these sentiments for Mormonism and what the church is, or what most people see the church being in the world. Conservative, detached, supportive of the existing government, even to its obvious crimes. But I must tell you this. I absolutely believe that my Mormonism, the Mormonism of my parents, the Mormonism of service and empowerment, the revolutionary proselytizing Mormonism, is the true one. So I offer this experience as my own, and I believe as that of many others. Some have left the organization of the church, but carry on their revolutionary beliefs in other settings. Others sit quietly, perhaps in pews, and listen to their own voices while their brothers and sisters pray things for family unity vacations on Lake Powell, or whatever is their pleasure. Often, I meet these other Mormons, and we share our passions for the pillars of our faith, and it is sweet and gives us new energy. Then again, sometimes when I sit there in my church, some little wonderful thing happens that affirms in me that I am not as totally alone as I have come to expect to feel. For example, last year I heard a wonderful rumor that a man named Moody had traveled officially for the church to Africa. There, as I heard the story, he heard some African members of the church singing old LDS hymns. Among them was my favorite, "Come, O Thou King of Kings." He said, however, that they sang it very slowly, almost as though it were a liberation hymn, solemn, defiant, full of determination against oppression. Almost immediately after I heard this beautiful story, I was asked to lead song practice in our ward, so I asked the ward to sing this hymn, slowly and powerfully. They did, and it went to my core. It was the way I've always expected Mormons to sing and sound and feel. Some people mentioned that they loved it as I did, but I could tell that others were not connected to that liberation message that I felt so powerfully in that song. I was teaching Relief Society that same day, so I went in, and as I began, a beautiful black woman came in, and I thought she looked African. So I asked her where she was from, and she said yes, she was from Nigeria, and she was visiting. She was not a member, but she had heard some missionary lessons in Los Angeles. I told her we had a song to sing for her, and I asked her to say afterwards what the song seemed to be about to her. We Relief Society sisters sang, again slowly, "Come, O Thou King of Kings." She had never heard it before, but she said clearly it was a liberation song. It was about her people, she said, wanting and waiting to be free. She liked it, she said, and commented that it was about throwing off the control of the colonial people who had oppressed them for so long. I thought so too, but I must say it meant the world to me to have someone else in my ward house say that there that day. I felt like I did when I was a little girl first learning what the gospel meant. This is a personal story, yes, but I want you to please understand that it is not intended as simply an anecdote, a reminiscence, for my self-understanding only. For me, it is not. It is the testimony of living Mormonism that I bear to the world. If I did not believe that I had the heart of Mormonism, for myself and for others, I would go look elsewhere. But I do not. This is what it is, this faith, concern, and revolutionary determination. This is what Mormonism is at its best and most necessary and vital. It can change the world. It is revolutionary. We're out of time. But if you have questions, I encourage you to stay and talk to the panelists. Thank you very much for coming today.